Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations wrapped up in books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And today on our show, our studio guest is Preeti Taneja, talking about her epic, in every sense of the word, debut novel, We That Are Young. We'll also hear from Eleanor Manu from Piku Publishing about the trials of running a small press. And University Challenge superstars Eric Monkman and Bobby Siegel will talk about their new quiz book. But first of all, welcome to the show, Preeti.
Hi.
Nice to have you here. We're going to give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But as I say, we're talking to Eleanor Manion later about running a small press. Now, you are published by Galley Beggar Press, I suppose technically a small press, although they seem to punch way, way above their weight.
Galley Beggar Press are a very small independent publishing house based in Norwich, and the books they put out have this sort of wild ambition and huge reach, which is very exciting to be part of.
I was going to say, is it good for you to be part of a press? Does it feel perhaps more inclusive than being part of a larger publishing house?
It definitely does. I think what I've discovered is that the Galley Beggar authors are like a family, so we all go to each other's events and we support each other and we celebrate each other's successes and we sort of gnash our teeth with each other, for each other, and it's been really wonderful to be part of that. I can always email one of them if I'm having a sort of writing crisis. It's like an extended family, and the editorial input and support that you get from a smaller press is also fantastic. I mean, I have never been published by a huge press. Till now, the book is going into different countries and so on, and that's in a much bigger publishing environment. But certainly, my experience has been that the care and attention that every stage of the process has shown to this book, from me selling it in to them right through to it being placed with the journalists and the newspapers, has been extraordinary. And that's because it's a small press.
Yes, you've got more control over it, so you've got more ownership over it.
Yeah, and they also time into every single stage of the process, and they keep me informed about what they're doing, so it's quite collaborative.
And you were at a speaking event recently, and I was there, and there were, I think, three members of the publishing house there, so yeah, they really do support you.
Two of them, yeah, but Sam Jordison and Eloise Miller, who run Galley Beggar Press, were there, and the other one was my partner.
Oh, right. An honorary member. Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll give you a proper introduction, I'll say, in just a moment, but we'll listen to your first choice of music now, which is Stay With You by John Legend. Why have you chosen this one?
Well, it's a love song, on paper, but actually I lost my mum to cancer when I was 28 years old, and I had spent a long time caring for her. After university, I was hoping to become a journalist. I wanted to be a writer, but she got very sick, and I went home to look after her with the rest of my family. She was an extraordinary person. She was a chef, a businesswoman, an entrepreneur, and a cookery writer herself. And she just promised me that whatever I did, she would always be there for me. So something about this song just says everything about that.
We've been together for a while now. We're growing stronger every day now. It feels so good and there is no doubt. I will stay with you. As each morning brings a sunrise and the flowers bloom in springtime, on my loving you can rely.
That's John Legend and Stay With You, the first choice of music on Bookmark today of our studio guest, Preeti Taneja. Preeti, you all right? I know that was quite an emotional song for you to hear, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's got that promise of something beyond all of the dark things and the bad things that happen in life, that someone is always there looking over your shoulder.
She'd be very proud of you, I'm sure. Preeti co-founded and edits Visual Verse, an online anthology of art and new writing. She's an AHRC BBC Radio 3 new thinker and also writes for The Guardian, New Statesman and The Observer. Her novella Kum Kum Malhotra won the Gatehouse Press New Fictions Prize, and her debut novel We That Are Young was published earlier this year. A modern-day King Lear set against the Indian anti-corruption riots of 2011 and 12, it chronicles the bitter and sometimes brutal implosion of the Devaraj family while making searing observations about politics and poverty in India and the position of women. The Spectator called it dazzlingly original, and the Sunday Times said it was revelatory, one of the most exquisite and original novels of the year. It is an amazing novel, I have to say. I concur with that. Those reviews, Preeti, how did that feel getting those?
Well, the Sunday Times review is my first review, and it was just a dream. After the years of work that it took to make the book and the journey I had been on personally to get it to the stage where it was ready to go into the world, there comes a point where you just have to let go because it's going into a publishing schedule and that's a business. And other writers had told me, you know, don't be disappointed, don't take any of it very seriously, the bad stuff is just as relevant as the... I had so many conflicting views, but then this dream review came out and it was my first one, and it just couldn't have been better. It was a wonderful day.
The first of many. And it's a challenging novel. I mean, let's not deny that. It's told from multiple perspectives. It moves about in time. And it's a long novel as well. How did you write it?
Well, excuse me. Because it's based on King Lear, I did have a skeleton plot structure. And I was able to take those five voices, who are the five characters, young people in the play, three daughters and two sons, and sort of look at the structure of the play and see if I could work out how these scenes would shuffle into the structure that I wanted to write in the book. And that happened actually very naturally. When you look at the play and you look at, you know, the main characters in each scene, those five young people have their foregrounding. So that worked really well. And then it was just a question of concentrating on each of those discrete sections one by one. So even though when they come together, it does feel like a huge thing, it was actually written as, you know, 100 pages belong to this character, 100 pages belong to the next character, and edited like that too. And I was actually quite surprised when I first saw the finished book, how big it was, because I was so used to working on it in these very discrete sections.
Yes, it's over 500 pages long, isn't
it?
We talked to another author recently, Karen Freeborn, about her novel, Presenting the Fabulous O'Learys, which also used King Lear as a basis. What is it about this story that appeals to people and seems to be such an inspiration for writers?
It just contains a social world which we still recognise. And I think for me, the most compelling thing about it is an argument that's made by scholars, actually, who look at the play and look at the lines on the page, and they see that in this world, there are people struggling for a better world. And the social system that they're locked in, that they also perpetrate, is just keeping them in place. And I think something about the play just really resonates in that way. Because as audience members or as readers, we can see that struggle. We can see what's stopping them. And it's each other. They're all sort of playing off against each other all the time. And all of these structures of power that are in their minds, patriarchy and, you know, social hierarchies of class or gender or anything like that. And you can see almost how things could be different. If only they would just be different. And sometimes they are struggling to do that, and then sometimes they just succumb to the worst. And that's what makes it so beautiful and tragic and so compelling.
And you mentioned gender there, and of course there's a lot about father-daughter relationships, which you use to explore the position of women in India.
Yeah, and I think recently we've seen that isn't just India. In India, it is a lot more part of daily life, and you can fight it much more clearly almost. You know, you can see how it stymies women, you can see how women struggle against it, and you can cheer along when some women break out of that system, which of course they do, just as they do in all societies. But when you start to think about how insidious that gendered power imbalance is here in the UK, in America, even in systems where, you know, any system where there's a huge amount of money going around it, there's glass ceilings and then sexual violence, it's excuse me, all sorts of things like that happen. And in India, it's just very much more concentrated, I think.
And when you're working with something like King Lear, how much do you mind the text, the actual text of the play?
Well, King Lear offers you the chance to just go to town with that kind of violence, unfortunately. And it's as if Shakespeare was trying to say something. King Lear's often portrayed as this sort of tragic, heroic figure, but he's absolutely awful to his daughters. And he is deeply scared of feminine power. He's deeply, as a character, threatened by these two older daughters who want to take each other by the hand and stand together. I mean, that is so powerful as women for us to do. So, you know, you can really, as a writer, look at the ways in which he uses his curses and his language and his appeals to gods and the ways in which he talks about the female body. And all of those things are in the text that I've written in We That Are Young. I do adhere quite strongly to Shakespeare's own language. It's in the sentences.
And in the rhythms.
Yeah.
But is it a problem that people know the ending of King Lear?
Lots of people don't, actually. because the book has this wide reach between India and Shakespeare, you know, and Shakespeare is often done in different countries and in different cultures in different ways. The ending of Lear, I don't think it does. I don't know. Some people say, oh, yeah, we know the ending, but they're more interested in how you're going to get there then. So it's a different kind of puzzle for them. And if you don't know the ending, you're just going to have a massive heartbreaking shock, I think.
Yeah, and your ending is slightly different as well.
It is slightly different. I think I make some of the gaps in Lear a bit more explicit. There's always stuff about the play that's troubled me. And I wanted to go to those parts of it too.
And you weave in Indian myths as well into the text. When you're writing, and you must have been aware that, obviously it's going to be read in India, but read by a Western reader who may not be aware of those myths, how do you deal with that?
I'm interested in this concept of what a Western reader is. I'm a Western reader. My sister's a Western reader. There are many, many people in this country who are very aware of those myths, and they would call themselves Western in some very important senses. Those myths perhaps haven't become as mainstream here as Shakespeare is all over the world. That's partly to do with colonisation and the way that knowledge is disseminated all over the world. If you aren't aware of those Indian myths, you have a journey of discovery to go on, just as if you were reading and you didn't know the Shakespeare. So there's two things that you have very much talking with each other all the way through the book. And that is the closest expression of what it means to me to be a second generation immigrant, I think, because those two worlds exist in me. And they've come out in the way that these young people think and speak and navigate very, very easily those two cultures.
And those two worlds really rub up against each other in Sita in particular, don't they? Yeah. It's the Cordelia character.
Yeah, Sita is probably one of our most culturally exported mythological figures. She is very much the sort of model of the good Indian girl. And that's how she's been read, a lot like Cordelia, who's supposed to be this perfect daughter who, even though she causes all of this chaos at the beginning of the play, she's understood as doing it for her father's own good, which I think is a little bit suspects. For me, Cordelia and Sita and these feminine role models, they can't be held up as perfect models of goodness. For me, they're very, very subversive women. They're very strong women. It takes a lot to say nothing to a demand to speak. And in the same way, you know, Sita in the Ramayana, she goes through this trial by fire, which is meant to test her purity after she's been lost in the forest or kidnapped or whatever. And she does it, but, you know, the ground opens and swallows her up because actually she shouldn't be tested in the first place. So she just removes herself from the situation. And for me, those two characters, the way they've been understood inside a very patriarchal world, but what they're actually doing is quite subversive. So yeah, that's why she's called Sita. And the word Sita actually means field, which ties in with a kind of eco-criticism of the problems that we're facing in the environment that run through the book.
Yes, we'll come back and we'll talk about the politics and your view on the politics later, because that, as you say, is a theme that runs through the book. But we talked about small presses earlier, and we'll hear now from Eleanor Mannion. She's Managing Director of Piku Publishing. They publish a range of books for children. As well as working with authors and illustrators from English-speaking countries, Piku prides itself on bringing its readers talented new authors in translation. It also unearths some classic texts, redesigning them for a modern audience. When I went to visit Eleanor, her Piku headquarters in Barkway, I asked her, well, you'll hear. We're sitting around a table with coffee and shortbread. This is not how some people would think a publishing company looks.
Well, there are a lot of small publishers now who are operating from home. I have a home office upstairs, and there's a lot that can be done at long distance now. And so as the owner and proprietor, I can work with a small band of freelancers and make it happen from home.
Be a publisher, you don't need to have big machines whirling in the background.
Not at all, no. You need to have the ideas, the contacts, a vision, and people can help you along the way.
Yeah, so what exactly does a publisher do? Do you have a typical day?
Well, a typical day is answering a lot of emails and contacting booksellers, contacting potential co-edition partners in other countries where we've got the rights to license the books overseas. I do a lot of the editorial work and design direction on the covers. Every day is a big mixture. You never quite know what's going to happen, which is lovely.
And how many books have you published?
I think it's about 15 so far, yes.
And all children's books?
We did a couple of adult humour books connected to parenting right at the beginning, but now we are totally focused on children's picture books.
And why children's books?
Well, I spent about 16 years selling illustrated adult non-fiction, and then I took a career break. I had children, and that took me back into the world of children's books. As well as rediscovering my own childhood through them, I just saw how I loved the books and they loved the books, and it was a real connection with that genre. And I felt that I wanted to get, if I got back into publishing, that I wanted to get into that area rather than back into the adult area.
And what makes a good children's book?
Oh, well, you'll have seen the huge variety out there, so it's a really difficult question to answer. But I think if you can connect to the child's point of view and remember what the world looks like to a child, that's a very good starting point. And I think the best authors and authors who've stood the test of time have managed to do that. They've somehow connected with the child inside themselves and remembered how that world can seem to a child. But we need great illustrators, and they do the same thing in their own way as authors. I like books which are hard working, that don't take a lazy approach to narration and illustration. So our books will have strong narratives and very strong illustrations and a certain authenticity. We're too small to list fill, so every book has to matter.
And because you're using illustrations and text, and where the text goes in relation to the illustrations, it's important, very important how they look.
It is. They've got to marry up very well. I think the best books will have a deep relationship between the illustration and the text. If we're reading aloud, and I'm a firm believer that reading aloud is really important, no matter how little time we have these days, you need to remember that while you're reading, if the child isn't yet at that stage, their eyes are on the picture. And so what is it from that text that you're reading that has been pulled out by your illustrator at that point, and what is it the child will be focusing on as the words are being absorbed that you're reading? So that's another thing to watch out for, that there is that relationship there.
And I noticed that a lot of your authors, well, you've got a very international list, haven't you?
Yes, so we started by rediscovering gems from the past. We felt that there was more out there than the big names that we all know. And a lot of titles now that we're doing will be from the 1960s, which is a sort of vintage era. But those would be British authors. And then we do have connections into Scandinavia. So we've been publishing some books by Finnish authors and trying to broaden the range of Nordic books in the UK.
And is the Nordic children's book different to a British children's book?
I think the point of view is wonderful. I think they're very connected to childhood, the essence of childhood in Scandinavia. They have fantastic literacy rates and they produce very, very creative illustrators and authors, and a refreshing point of view, I think. Sometimes we need to knock ourselves sideways a little bit to see the world again, and I think the best Scandinavian authors do that.
And you talked about rediscovering classics. Which of those have you got on your list?
Well, we've published the storybooks of Elizabeth Clarke, who has been in print, I think, more or less continuously for nearly 100 years. But her storybooks have been out of print for a long, long time, and we found her heir in a village near Lincoln, and she gave us permission to reissue her great aunt's storybooks. So Elizabeth Clarke is a wonderful rediscovered author on our list, and we've just this month published her a collection of her Christmas stories, which are timeless, and she completely understood how to narrate a story carefully and slowly to young children. She was on Children's Hour, and she was a real pioneer and a woman who made her own way in the world of books very, very early. So we're proud to have her.
So you receive submissions, you receive manuscripts.
We do, far too many for our size, but we like to have a look at what's out there and what people are offering. And we hope in the near future that we'll be commissioning authors of our own, yes.
And when you read a manuscript, how early do you know in the manuscript whether it's one for you?
I think I just want to keep reading is the answer to that.
And what next for you then?
We want to start commissioning our own books in the future. So we are looking out for illustrators and some young talent, I'm sure, is out there. We've got a few ideas of sorts of books we could commission. And we want to expand our Nordic range, very much so. Vintage books will remain a part of the list, so we'll keep publishing William Pappas's books from the 1960s because they are still beautiful fables and valuable books to have on our list. And any other rediscovered gems that we find.
And obviously you still think there's a place for books in this world of screens and Kindles.
Well, last year printed books sales rose by about 7%, I think. So they are going up, and sales of Kindles are falling, I believe. So I think that there's evidence that children particularly do like to hold a book, to feel a book, and I think we're all reevaluating why we like books now that we have the choice. And I think it's clear that a book is a beautiful item to own, as well as something to enjoy reading. Yeah, I don't think books are going to go away. I think quite the opposite.
It's a competitive marketplace, though, for a publisher, is it?
Tremendously competitive. So we have to work so hard to get our books seen by booksellers. That's the job of the reps and myself. We just keep plugging away. We've got a great publicist, and we get great support from local outlets like Heffers, the Berry Lane Farm Shop, and farm shops are becoming quite a destination where you can buy books. And of course, David's Bookshop in Letchworth, which is one of the best bookshops in the UK.
And some might argue that actually it's small presses are flourishing at the moment. It's this marketplace is really for them. You know, lots of small presses seem to be winning awards for their books.
Yes, I think some small presses are doing very well. There are a lot of awards these days, and the independents, I think, really do try to support the smaller publishers. But there are more and more outlets as well. So the small independent publisher can go to so many more outlets which are non-traditional, we would say. So you've got your garden centres and farm shops and galleries and country houses. I think that is where the future is for a lot of publishers, beyond the traditional bookshop.
And talking about children's books, what's your favourite children's book? Is the one that you remember reading and rereading as a child?
the ones that I've read with my children stick in my mind most, because we've shed many a tear over some of them and a lot of laughter. We really have enjoyed the Enid Blyton books. I mean, they are absolutely fantastic for young children. Charlotte's Web, I think, moved us so much. I think that would have to be one of my top ones. And Anne of Green Gables for older children. So the classics are still there, I think, for me, in my heart. But there are plenty of lovely, lovely new books out there. South was a beautiful one. I like Klassen's style. You know, the list is endless, really.
That was Eleanor Mannion from Piku Publishing. If you want to find out more about them, their website is pikupublishing.com, and Piku is P-I-K-K-U. You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. Our studio guest today is Preeti Taneja. There was talk there of David's Bookshop in Letchworth. You say you grew up in Letchworth?
Yes, I did. And I have to say, bookshops and libraries were my refuge when I was a child. As well as David's Bookshop, where I spent quite a lot of time reading, my parents used to bring us here to Cambridge, where there used to be Heffer's Children's Bookshop across the street from what's currently now Main Heffer's. And they would just leave us to read books while they went and did their whatever they wanted to do, shopping, maybe have a cup of tea or whatever. It was a different time when, you know, by the time they came back, we'd have like a stack of 20 books and we were allowed to pick three each or something and then go home. Yeah, so those were the places I remember finding my stories.
And I'll ask you the same question I asked Eleanor. Is there a particular children's book that you remember?
Sorry, I've got horrible
don't worry. Call.
Charlotte's Web, she mentioned, that is such a tearjerker. But and I loved Anne of Green Gables as well. My mum used to bring us back from her trips to India, Amar Chitra Katha, which is a comic book series about Indian mythology, because she wanted us to have that side of our lives just as catered for. And I think nowadays there are much more books for British Asian children and black and ethnic minority characters in them and telling those stories from different parts of the world, which I think is really important because we all live here. But for me, a childhood books that I probably would just press on anyone. I had a book called Charlotte Sometimes, and it was about a girl at boarding school. Her life was nothing like mine, obviously, but she fell asleep and woke up in a different time where she met her doppelganger, Claire. And it was just so beautifully done. The exchange and the dilemma between these two girls, because they both loved their lives, but they loved each other's lives. They missed home, but they found new homes in different times. And something about that duality really spoke to me.
Oh, that does sound good.
It was very good.
That one out. Are we going to listen to your second choice of music now, which is A Long Walk by Jill Scott? Why this one?
Well, I love walking in cities, and it's probably the thing I would always connect with, the feeling of being free. There's a certain kind of community you can get from walking alone in an urban environment, and it just liberates my imagination. I always come back with 100 new ideas. I often stop and write them down as I go. I've listened to this song so many times in my writing process when I wanted to clear my head and allow those ideas to come to me.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And our studio guest on Bookmark today is Preeti Taneja. And Preeti, you're going to read now an extract from We That Are Young.
Rudrabai, can you swim and can you fly? this from Felix, a busty boy, 7 years old, in a faded Kokiz It t-shirt and cut-off pants. Rudrabai, do you remember everything about your past life? This from another boy, Akul, about 13, but short, with no pa, always begging for stories of drinking, ganja, and the ability to blow rings from a pipe, as unimaginable girls, fishy, tried to hook cheat with their made-up smiles and their size. Rudrabai, what is the worst thing you have ever done? This from Nakul, his identical twin, who came out second, he tells them each time, as if this makes him more willing to believe that Rudra the Sage was once a babu named Jeet Singh. Rudrabai, what does it take to kill a man? Silence. The boys look up at Samir, their 14-year-old leader, who always seems to find the treasure in the rubbish pile, a gold pendant, a half bottle of hot pink nail polish, a silk heritage label tie around his dear head. Samir, whose father wears a company uniform to guard the back gate of the Amritsar Hotel, and who has a pair of proper shoes, flat leather lace-ups with scratched red soles, too big, a found pair, but his own. The day before the storm breaks over Dimbala, Jeet will sit under his tree, watching the boys through half-closed eyes. He wonders what Samir had to do to get those shoes. Is he a con artist? A spy? No. Jeet must not suspect Samir's sweet smile. This is the path he has chosen, to try to be clean, to be good, and to think only pure thoughts and set himself towards salvation, to remember that he is Rudra, Rudra, Rudra. Each day, the hour comes when the busty boys will climb off the dump. They will gather around Jeet at the foot of the tree, dark skins covered in scraps of fluttering white plastic, as if they are mosaics of themselves. They will pick and pull the scraps off each other, pester him with questions such as, what does it take? Ask for stories before they go home to their shacks. They demand these stories straight, beginning, middle, end. But he is Jeet Singh, his mouth is dry. He is striving as hard as he can to be Rudra and Naaf Sage. His calling is not to simplify these boys' lives. He tells his stories in vernacular circles, backwards and around, for his own sanity, to stay here. He must teach the boys that life is not lived in linear fashion. They must learn what it means to be the future of those ancient tongues that count no time but today. They gather for stories, watched over by the back of the Amritsar Company Hotel, its white facade pocked with air conditioning units, the walls stained with black streaks, as if the windows are weeping mascara tears. Dimbala spreads across a scoop of land formed by an ancient lake bed long dry. It is at least 2 kilometres wide, maybe 3. But how would Jeet know this or count? All he knows is that the shacks of this place have spread like fungus in a bowl, taking no heed of the state border, spreading, spreading, until they stop at the high stone walls of the old Nepethala Palace, where Bapuji was once a boy. Half the rim of the busti is edged by a cracked plain, where stilted, rusted advertising hoardings show washing machines, dishwashers, pictures of the beach peeling in strips to reveal Bapuji's face, and Nanu's, their hands in namaste battered from years of monsoons and harsh, dry heat. The slogan in patches across each board reads, Company City, coming soon. Soon, Jeet thinks, sitting under his tree, I will go on. I will join the pilgrim's route to Amarnath. I will get the blessing of Lord Shiv and see for myself the lingam formed of ice that waxes and wanes. Among so many pilgrims of all purses, I will walk, all of my sins will be cleared. Yet, even the day before the storm, when his mind will reach this freewheeling point, when the tiny scars all over his arms have faded to thin white lines, and he tries to count the weeks he has been here, is it 4, 5, 6? He will not leave. Instead, he tries to think about what he has been asked and how he has come to this.
Thank you, Preeti. That's a section from one of the most shocking and vivid parts of the book, because it's about this massive tip and sewage dump called the Basti and the life of the people on there. Is this based on a real place?
Well, Dimbala Basti is a made-up place, but it is based on my experiences of working in human rights and humanitarian work for many years, when I had the opportunity to go into places a lot like Dimbala and meet people who are living there and making their lives there. And their stories were always of resilience. Their places where they lived were always spotless, no matter how disgusting the environments that they actually lived in were. And I worked as a human rights reporter, so I was there to really either train people in how to use videos or look at how they were teaching their children to read and, you know, do book projects and things like that. Every single time, I was just absolutely aghast at the way in which society kind of dumps upon these people and then sort of blames them for it, because we don't choose how our lives go, we don't choose how we're born, but we can choose how we respond. And that's what you learn when you work with people in those situations.
And of course, this is contrasted with the opulence of the hotels that the family runs. I mean, the political points are come thick and fast. Were you always going to make a political statement in this book?
I think it was unavoidable, yeah. My sister once asked me why I could be a bit less political, and I was just like, I don't know, that's just the way I am. I just grew up that way. I read very widely when I was, from a very young age, and the books I loved, from, you know, Charlotte sometimes to Jane Eyre when I was a teenager to King Lear as an A-level student, everything about those books is to do with social injustice. And it trains you to see those things. As a writer, if you don't speak out about them, if you don't put them in your work, who are you? What are you for? I don't know.
And what's been the response in India to the book?
Indian responses. The book came out there about 4 weeks ago, and the responses have been really brilliant. It's very interesting to see on the side of the Shakespeare in the UK that what people have picked up on, whereas in India the responses have really been to do with the Indian mythology and the portrayal of Indian women, and the Indian women who have reviewed the book are just like, yes. And it isn't an easy book, I will give you that. It does show a world which seems very bleak, but I think if literature does that, then it gives us an opportunity to decide what we want to do differently. Because I don't think reading is just about escape and then shutting the book and moving on to the next thing.
No, I agree. And I would recommend it. No, it's not let's be clear, it's not a barrel of laughs.
Well, it's based on a great tragedy.
Based on a great tragedy. But it's incredibly moving and informative.
Thank you.
And that's what writing has to be about, isn't it? Well, let's take a sideways shift now. We'll come back to you in a moment, Preeti. But now, Eric Monkman and Bobby Siegel caught the viewing public's eye and imagination following their appearances on the 2017 series of University Challenge. Both captained Cambridge teams, Bobby Emmanuel and Eric Wolfson College, and they faced off against each other in the show's semi-final, with Wolfson eventually beaten by Balliol College Oxford in the final. Now the former rivals have bonded together to write the Monkman and Siegel quiz book. I asked Eric when we met whether he and Bobby knew each other before that semi-final.
We did. We actually met through University Challenge practice. So to prepare for the show, different Cambridge teams play against each other. It's probably the best preparation you can get for the show, is playing in as if you were on television.
Yeah, so I used to organise weekly practice for the Cambridge teams, and Eric's Wilson team used to come along to the practices. So almost like being on set, but without any cameras there.
Oh, serious then? Yeah. Weekly practice? You were in it to win it?
Quite serious, yeah. But fun. Mm. But fun too.
Now, of course, following the broadcast of University Challenge, your profile, your public profile, went through the roof. And now here you are, you're famous and you've got a book out in your name. How does that feel?
Well, it's a lot of fun when people say, you know, either recognise us or say something online and say that we brought them some happiness, you know, that they enjoyed seeing the show, or, you know, they watched along and, you know, they got so many questions right in a game that we were, one of us or both of us were in, because it's a hobby that we both very much enjoy. And it's fun to be able to share that experience with a lot of others, even if they're just playing along at home.
An unexpected outcome, though, of being on the show.
Mm, it is. And I think one of the positive side effects is that we've almost become like ambassadors for the fact that learning is a good thing. And obviously it's not been out of fashion, but it's always good to have people out there like Eric and I who can say, actually, it is good to know some facts, it is good to know things, especially in a modern era where young people just seem to rely, especially my students, on Google
And when did you realise, at what point did you realise that, hey, this has sort of become, got a life of its own?
You know, I think the first episode I was on, people were talking about me on Twitter, and I had no idea that there was that much attention to the show. I mean, this isn't something that we have an equivalent for in Canada. So it was a very big surprise to me. Quizzing is something that people do in Canada, although we call it trivia. But it for university level trivia, it doesn't get televised. So it's a bit like the university chess club. People who are in it love it. They're very enthusiastic about it. They know everybody else. They know who the good players are. But outside of that group, it's not really paid a whole lot of attention outside. And but it was a very big surprise, you know, pretty much from the get-go to see the level of attention that people here give it.
Was that your experience
as
well?
Yeah, so it built up over a case of a few months. For me, one match in particular was our second round match against SOAS, University of London. So the first match, we got through and people noticed my fist pumping and sort of supporting the team quite vociferously. But in the second match, it was less tense because we were taking their lead. So I really relaxed, smiled a lot, we joked around a lot. And I think teams or the public really enjoyed that. And then it sort of took off from there.
And Eric, I mean, you were described as the most intense contestant ever to have appeared on University Challenge. How did that feel?
Well, I don't know whether that's true, but if it is, I think it's a good way to be on that show, because if you want to do well on the show, you really need to concentrate on just getting the next answer right. You don't concentrate on the score. You don't concentrate on what else is going on. Just how do I either answer this next question or, you know, decide to leave it to one of my teammates gets it. Of course, the best feeling, I think, on the show is when you hit the buzzer, you hear the name of your team, and then you realize that you don't know it, and then they need to name one of your teammates who gets it. So it's not all, it's really is a team game, though, as well.
And what we're seeing, of course, on the program is just these little snippets of your character, aren't we? So whether it's accurate or not is another thing.
There is, especially in this modern day era where social media magnifies the sort of public view on contestants, there sometimes it can portray an accurate view of candidates or people on the show, but sometimes they're completely different, offset. Some people decide just to focus, some people become very shy on the show, some people get very nervous and talk a lot more than they would do. So actually it's not necessarily a real depiction, but again, that's what the public will perceive.
Well, tell me about this quiz book. How did that come about?
So we had a few publishers approach us, some individually, some the pair of us, and we decided to go for Eyewear. We really like the fact they're an independent press, and in fact the main director, Todd Swift, is a visiting scholar at Pembroke College, Cambridge, so there's an added connection, and he's Canadian, so we've got lots of connections to Eyewear, and we felt that it was a very collaborative effort, inviting the quiz book.
Mm. So they approached you together?
No, for this particular one, they approached Eric.
Me, and then I think we sort of teamed up and said, if we're going to write this, I thought it would be, I don't know whether it would have been something that I would have done by myself, but I think it's a fun thing to do as a collaborative effort with a friend.
But you're very brainy. I mean, is this a quiz book for everybody?
So there's one section there. I've looked at the Key Stage 2 curriculum. That's for 11-year-olds, for those that don't know, and actually written 50 questions that a primary school child should be able to answer. And on the other end of the scale, we've got University Challenge style starters for 10, which are very challenging. So it covers the whole spectrum.
So you did really write it. Both of you did really write this because, you know, we're all familiar with celebrities who put their names to books that they've never even seen.
It's all us with some helpful editorial support, very good editorial support from Rosie Hildyard, one of the Eyewear employees, and the rest of the Eyewear team.
So they helped you structure the book. Because I suppose when you're thinking about a quiz book, there are so many topics and age ranges, as you say, and they helped you structure it so that it is something for all the family.
Absolutely, because they're the ones who've got experience in publishing. We've hopefully got the interest in general knowledge to help generate enough questions.
And did you look at each other's sections?
We did, yes. Tried them out. It was fun.
So what are you doing now?
I'm still at Emmanuel College, Cambridge. I'm doing a part-time doctorate in education, specialising in maths, and I'm also teaching at Chesterton Community College. So I'm a sort of teacher by day, student by night, and evening and weekend, and every other moment I've got.
And that's with a view to doing what, eventually?
My long-term goal is I want to help change the perception of maths in the country. So I think too many people have a negative attitude towards maths, and it means that they have almost like a lifelong negative reaction to the subject. And it means that it impairs them in a lot of daily practical things, like whether they're paying bills or looking at car insurance or planning a holiday. So my goal is to sort of be a maths evangelist, as it were. So I'm actually currently coaching the Emmanuel team.
You're coaching? Goodness me, Bobby. You are competitive. You're coaching them.
Exactly. Captain Seagull. Or Coach Seagull, rather. I was Captain Seagull before I'm Coach Seagull.
And what do you think their chances are?
Good. They're a good team. They're a very young team.
And what about you, Eric?
Well, I've just finished a 3-month internship at The Economist, where I wrote about finance and economics. It was a really great experience, quite humbling, I would say, to have a magazine that I read myself and have read for years, and to be normally reading it and then turn the page and there's something I've written. It was just an excellent experience for me. So now I'm taking a little bit of time to see more of the UK, taking a bit of a vacation around the UK and doing some book promotion, which has been a lot of fun. And then I think it's time for a vacation, for a holiday, a bit of a longer vacation, head back home, spend some time with family.
Yes, because you're from Canada originally.
I am, yes.
Whereabouts?
Just outside Toronto in a place called, the suburb called Oakville.
Oh, that sounds beautiful. Mm. And your long-term goal then, would that be to obviously to work within economics?
Well, keep watching this space. You'll have to let people find out.
Yeah, there's something afoot there. The McMenna Seagull quiz book is published by Eyewear Publishing. We're coming to the end of our time with you, Preeti Taneja, on Bookmark, which is a great show. It's been lovely talking to you. What next for you now, then?
Well, the book is carrying on its own journey, and I feel like I'm sort of steering the ship, or not, someone else is steering the ship, and I'm just on board now. It's coming out in America next year, which is really exciting, and in a few other places around the world, so I'm really looking forward to that. And I'm doing a bunch of other things in my everyday life. I teach a prison writing course, and I'm also teaching on an MA course at Warwick University, as well as thinking about what to write next.
What to write next,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, I think it's going to be set in the northeast of the UK, where I spent half my childhood in Middlesbrough.
Wow, so very different.
Yeah, yeah.
Very different. And a question that we ask all our guests on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment?
Well, I am taking a break from Indian writing in English at the moment, and I'm actually reading another Gallibega Press book by a young writer called Gonzalo C. Garcia, and it's set in Santiago, and I'm reading it. He's sort of next in line after me in the Gallibega publishing list, and I'm really excited to read it. It's about worlds that I don't know anything about, sort of boys, gaming, music, this lost character whose his girlfriend's left him, and he's got the turkey in the freezer, and he ends up kind of crying under his desk every day. It's hilariously funny, which is a skill as a writer I have yet to cultivate. So I'm really enjoying just relaxing with this crazy Gonzalo creation.
That sounds wonderful.
It's called We Are the End.
We Are the End by Gallibega Press. And Gallibega Press are the publishers of your book that we've been talking about today, We That Are Young. We'll come back to you in just a moment, Preeti, to talk us out with your last choice of music. But just a heads up that on our next show, our studio guest will be Laura Purcell, talking about The Silent Companions. We'll also hear from Nicola Upson on her latest Josephine Tay mystery, Nine Lessons. And Samantha Ellis will be chatting to us about her biography of Anne Bronte. This is our last show before Christmas, so have a lovely Christmas and festive season. We will see you in 2018. We'll sign out now with your last choice of music today, Preeti. I'm going to need your help with this one, the pronunciation. It's Malika Pukraj and the track, can you help me?
Yeah, sure. The singer is Malika Pukraj. It's a Kavali, and it's called Abito Me Jovanhu, and it's actually, it translates as I'm Still Young, and it's a Sufi divine song, emotional, sort of raising a glass to youth and never wanting that youth to end. It's sort of song motif of the novel We That Are Young.
अभी तो मैं जवान हूँ अभी तो मैं जवान हूँ हवा भी खुशगवार है, गुलों पे भी निखार है, तरन्नुम में हजार है, बहार पुर बहार है, कहाँ चला है साकिया, इधर तो लौट इधर तो आ, इधर तो लौट।